From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
When you walk through the garden, gotta watch your back.
The HBO series The Wire is currently in its fifth and final season. On today's Fresh Air, we feature an interview with Clark Johnson. He directed the pilot, the second episode, and the final episode, and co-stars this season as Baltimore Sun city editor Gus Haynes. It's not the first time he's worked with the show's creator, David Simon. Johnson played Detective Meldrick Lewis on Homicide, which was based on a book by Simon and was also set in Baltimore. Johnson also directed the pilot and the forthcoming final episode of the cop series, The Shield. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a belatedly issued live album by singer and pianist Andy Bay and a reissue featuring him and his sisters. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're big fans of the HBO series The Wire, so we have a Wire doubleheader. Tomorrow, we'll hear from the actor who plays Omar, Michael K. Williams. My guest today is Clark Johnson. He directed the pilot of The Wire, the second episode, and the series finale, which will be shown in a few weeks. And on this fifth and final season, he's also on camera as Gus Haynes, the city editor of the Baltimore Sun. Johnson also directed the pilot and several other episodes of the FX cop series, The Shield, including the series finale, which has not yet been shown. Many of us first saw Johnson in the 90s on the TV series Homicide, playing Detective Meldrick Lewis. Homicide was based on a book by David Simon, who later created The Wire, which, like Homicide, is set in Baltimore. Simon has described The Wire as really about the American city and how we live, and about how institutions affect the individuals within them and the compromises those individuals are often forced to make. In this final season, Simon has added a new institution, the newspaper, specifically a fictionalized version of the Baltimore Sun, where Simon used to work. Clark Johnson, as Gus Haynes, the city editor, is upholding journalistic values that the editors above him seem willing to compromise. They want colorful stories that will get attention, even if the facts don't quite check out. In this scene, Gus is talking to a reporter named Scott Templeton, who was assigned to write a color story about the Orioles game. The story he's handed in is about a 13-year-old African-American boy who's in a wheelchair because a stray bullet left him paralyzed. The kid wants to see the game but can't afford to buy a scalp ticket. The reporter says he only knows the kid's nickname, no full name, no photo. Gus, the editor, expresses his skepticism to the reporter. Later in the scene, the managing editor intervenes.
The kid is nowhere to be found. I sent Photo down there to try to dig him up. Nothing.
Probably left.
Okay, so we got a poor black kid in a wheelchair with no ticket. He rolls himself from somewhere in West Baltimore to the shadow of the mighty brick-faced Coliseum known as Oriole Park, listening to the cheers from the crowd which told the whole tale.
I got a five.
We're going to give good play to a 13-year-old known only as EJ who declines to give his name because he skipped school. He's got no parents. He lives with his aunt. I mean, I'm not saying that this kid isn't everything you say he is, but Scott, damn, as an editor, I need a little more to go on if I'm going to fly this thing.
I resent the implication.
I'm not implying anything. I'm on your side. But the standard for us has to be...
Scott,
just finished your story. Good read. I'm putting it out front. I think you really captured the disparity of the two worlds in the city in a highly readable narrative. I wouldn't change a word.
Thanks, but I'm not sure everyone shares your enthusiasm.
Jim, aren't you just a little bit concerned that we don't even have a last name for this kid? I thought we held ourselves up to
it. It's not an ideal situation, no. But the boy's reluctance to give his last name clearly stems from his fear of being discovered as a truant. You have a problem with it?
Yeah, a little bit, kind of, yeah. I'm just saying that the standards
that
we have...
I think we're on terra firma here.
Gotcha. May I make a call? You good to go?
Clark Johnson, welcome to Fresh Air. Did you expect to get an acting part on the show after having directed the first two episodes years ago?
I hadn't really thought about it. I kept wanting to regain contact with the show because, you know, after having done the pilot in the first couple, I went off into feature film land and The Shield and things elsewhere. So I couldn't get back. So I had hoped to do one of the ones in the last season, and then the role came up, and it was a regular role for the season. And I thought, what a better way to finish this loop for me, to be involved as an actor and a director.
What did the creator of the show, David Simon, tell you about your part as the city editor at the Baltimore Sun and about the problems that Simon himself faced during the period of cutbacks and buyouts at the Baltimore Sun when he worked there?
Well, first of all, he let me know that the character was loosely based on him and his experiences, in a sense. And then Bill Zorzi, our other former Sun reporter who was now a producer and a great writer for the show, claims that the character is loosely based on him. So I took it from both of them, and that became the character.
David Simon was a reporter, not an editor, right?
Yeah, he was a reporter, but the newspaper guy, you know, it was the sensibility, the righteous indignation that comes out of my dialogue comes from his take on the state of print journalism.
I mean,
so,
I'm a huge fan of The Wire, but I didn't pick it up right away. I found it hard at first to keep track of all the characters because there's so many. You've got the cops, you've got the drug dealers, you've got the city government that you're following, and when the characters were all being introduced, I just couldn't keep track, and it took me a couple of seasons before I really went back and followed them. And I've actually heard this from other people, too, that it was initially hard for them to follow everything because there's so many characters to figure out early on. Now, I love these characters so much, but I'm wondering, when you started directing it and you were doing the episode, seeing all these characters who you had to establish in 1 hour, how did you handle that? Like, what were some of the challenges for you?
I think most of the characters were so well defined and so creatively drawn that I didn't have a problem with it with the pilot. Now, when I came back this season and had to reconnect, it was dense because, you know, people had come and gone and people were referred to that weren't on the show anymore, and it was pretty, you know, it was a lot of homework to get up to speed. And I think that that's one of the things that people attribute our so-called lack of a huge audience is that very thing, is that you got to work at it. You got to get in there and really get to know these people. It's dense. But as you experienced, once you do, you're kind of hooked. And that's why we have a great, passionately loyal fan base.
And that's why DVDs are so great, because you can always pick it up.
Right.
What were some of the guiding principles behind how the show was supposed to look when you started directing it?
Basically, the show itself has two things. It has a look of its own, and the place that it's set in is an important character. Now, Baltimore was an important character in this series, and the look of the show was quite different from the look of, say, The Shield, which was frenetic and handheld and run-and-gun 16mm embedded type of a style, whereas The Wire, because of the theme of the show, which is to surveil and to observe and to watch from a distance, we took the idea to do it with a long lens and just to be more settled and to watch from afar. And that's been the look of the show throughout, is that detached view of it.
Have you learned a lot of street slang from doing Homicide and The Shield and The Wire?
Well, the language evolves. You know, the colorful thing about any sub-lingo, if you want, is that it completely evolves. You know, you can go all the way to the streets of London, where they have that Cockney slang where they bangers and mash means absolutely something else, and that would change and morph into another phrase. So if you don't keep up with it, it becomes irrelevant really quickly. It's fine for, you know, a TV show, but it doesn't really represent what the kids are speaking like now. Like, for instance, my daughter goes to school in Paris. She's in college in Paris, and she's learning colloquial French in addition to her great, you know, school-taught French. And one of the phrases they use there is "Franchement, mon pote," which means "What up, homie?" in colloquial French. "Quoi neuf, docteur?" So things change.
Wait, what does it mean? I lost you.
"What up, homie?"
What up, homie? Oh.
"Franchement, mon pote." And I mean, you know, so things change, and we try to keep up with it. And David Simon has a great ear for it, and all those years on the beat, you know, as a service reporter, he would collect those things, and then of course he'd have to update them. And the kids that we hire on the show a lot of times come right off the street, so we tend to stay fairly current with that, I think.
So where does that leave you as a director when you're directing young people who have some, like, instinctual talent, but they're not trained?
Well, that instinctual talent is what I nurture and try to bring out, whereas we had a lot of stunt casting with reporters or former reporters from The Sun and people that Simon and Zorzi knew. And a lot of them, God bless them, great writers, but couldn't act worth a damn, you know. So it was easier to get stuff out of the kids who were, you know, open books, fresh takes on it than jaded, hardcore reporters trying to play themselves, be funny. So a lot of them are really charismatic and interesting off camera. As soon as they say action, they freeze up.
Yeah.
Whereas with the kids, it didn't happen too often.
So tell me what kind of advice you gave the kids.
I don't give advice unless it's asked for generally. I mean, I just, what I do as a director is I because I'm an actor, I watch. And as I watch, I'll tell the actor what I just saw. And if that's not what the actor was trying to present, then we'll discuss it and we'll say, well, how can we get that across? Because it looked to me like you were doing this. So that's pretty much applies to the way I raise my kids or the way I direct actors. You know, it's like, okay, here's what I saw.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Clark Johnson. And in the current series of The Wire, he plays Gus Haynes, who's the city editor at the Baltimore Sun. And he also directed the first two episodes of The Wire and directed the finale of The Wire, which is coming up in just a few weeks. He played Detective Mildred Lewis on Homicide and also directed the pilot and several other episodes of The Shield. In the first seasons, the gangs, the drug gangs, are in high rises and low rises of the housing
right.
projects. And the low rises... where the kids dealing the drugs stay is like on the lawn in front of the low rises, and they're sitting on like beat up easy chairs and beat up couches, and it's kind of like their office on the lawn. Was that a housing project that you were shooting in?
Yeah, that was. I mean, that couch actually, that's funny that you remind me of that because it's been a while. But Bob Colesbury, it was, I think it was his idea with that couch because it was just this old mangy couch, and we thought, okay, it's an office. And that wouldn't be inappropriate. I mean, kids, they're hanging out, and they're kids. I mean, that's the tragedy of it. What would these kids be doing if they were channeling these energies into something constructive other than drug dealing, which is often the only option some of them feel that they have? So that was really important for us to show them hiding in plain sight their activities. The other complication in Baltimore was a lot of those towers came down, and they were, you know, replaced with a more diverse housing situation that's supposedly, you know, it gives people a little more sense of pride than just those in personal high-rises. I remember in Philadelphia when I was a kid, the towers in the 40s off of Market Street, I'm walking by there because I'm from West Philly, and my uncle said, he looked up at the towers and said, they're just getting us ready for prison because, you know, the chain-link fence outside that... marks the hallways that are outside the building. So this is really relevant to us and to this story, that idea of future incarceration, bleak as that may seem.
My guest is Clark Johnson. He directed the first two episodes of The Wire, as well as the upcoming series finale. And on this final season, he plays Gus Haynes, the city editor of the Baltimore Sun. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Clark Johnson. On this season of the HBO series The Wire, he plays Gus Haynes, the city editor of the Baltimore Sun. Johnson also directed the pilot, the second episode, and the upcoming series finale. Were you around for the auditions for The Wire?
For the pilot?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the director, that's my job, is to be with, you know, Alexa Fogel is our casting director, and her, myself, and Simon, and Colesbury would have sessions and bring in hundreds of actors to New York and L.A. and Baltimore. Dominic's tape came from London. And then we take our primary choices out to HBO, and Carolyn Strauss and Albrecht would look at them, and then we'd make our decisions as to who got the roles. But, yeah, that's casting to me is as important as anything there is in a successful drama presentation.
Can you tell us one of your favorite casting stories?
I could, but it's visual and it's The Shield, you know. You want to talk about The Shield for a second? Because it's the classic audition
sure.
tape of all times.
Sure.
Well, the opening in the pilot of The Shield, Mike Chiklis and his strike team are chasing this drug dealer through thick and thin, all over the place, and this kid is swallowing his drugs and throwing stuff away as they're chasing him, and they catch him finally when he gets to a fence that he can't open. And he turns around and says, you lose, G-Man, or something like that. And Chiklis, and, you know, just punches him in the stomach, yanks down his pants, and he's got more drugs taped to his groin. And Chiklis tears the tape off, and the kid screams in agony, and he says whatever his line is. So we had this kid came into audition, and he you know, it's a standard thing in an audition process. It's a bleak little room with a couple of chairs, and the director and the casting people are sitting there looking at the poor actor who's standing at a piece of tape, and he's reading to a casting person off camera. And this kid came in, and he said his name and what role he was reading for, and we said action, and he took off running. He left the room. We could hear his footsteps receding down the hall. We're sitting there. We're so, what the hell's going on? And we kept rolling. And then the kid, we could hear his footsteps getting louder, and he came back to his mark. He said his line. He said Chiklis' line. He punched himself in the stomach. He pulled his own pants down. The camera girl, God bless her, tilted down because we knew no one would believe us. And there he was in all his glory. He had taped something, I didn't look that closely, to his groin and yanked it off himself. We panned up and he finished the scene, and we just sat there just in rapt amazement at this, the energy and the great effort that this kid had done to play everybody's role in the scene. And sadly, he didn't get the part, but it was the most remarkable.
After all that, he didn't get the part?
Isn't that pathetic?
Why, no, why not?
Because there's an actor that was better. I mean, actors live in a hard, harsh reality of too tall, too short, too happy, too sad, you know. That was one of the problems of me being a director is that I'm glad I was an actor first, because if I knew then what I know now, oh, my God, it's daunting how decisions are made.
So is there anything that you started in terms of a shooting style or a mood or whatever when you started doing The Wire that you think really kind of stuck and you could see that influence continuing now?
Yeah, the long lens look, and I actually got sick of it. No, I mean it's you know, Homicide was an amazing experience for me because, you know, a young actor, I had done another cop show before that called Night Heat, and before that I was a driver, you know, in the movies, and so the experience of Homicide and the way that show was shot just completely stuck with me, you know, and oddly enough, and this is not just a hindsight thing. At the time, because the camera was so frenetic and always in places where you didn't expect it to be, it took a while for us actors to get used to that conceit. And that was specific to that show. We predated NYPD Blue. And so once Homicide became the cool look, you couldn't watch a Ford commercial without seeing that same camera style. When The Shield came out Ron Schmidt and I had a real specific look to that show, and a lot of it had to do with adjusting the shutter, the angle of the shutter, so it gives it a sort of a choppy look that you can't quite pick up with your eye. That was really specific for that show. And then you see it in everything now. And you see the camera moving and being part of the other actor's perspective. Like if somebody's got something in his hand, we tilt down and we tilt up. Now I see it everywhere. Not that we're broke, you know, invented the wheel. It's just that once an idea hits, and I, you know, stole from Homicide. I'm not saying otherwise, but once something becomes part of the popular mosaic, it gets tired really quickly. When you have something that's really as groundbreaking as the look of Homicide or the look of The Wire or look of The Shield, it becomes part of the mainstream. And then, you know, anything like that, you don't want to do it anymore because, okay, now everyone's doing that. So I don't know. David Mamet once said, I don't know if that answers your question, but it's a damn good answer to something.
That's a very, very good answer. You did well on the answer. I'm assuming you're not going to tell us anything about how The Wire ends, even though you shot it and you're probably in it. Your character is probably in it. And plus, I want to be surprised. So even if you're going to tell me, I probably wouldn't.
Well, and the thing is, HBO gives us mind control drugs, and I don't even remember what happened now because they've erased it from our memories. I'm going to have to watch it with you because I don't know.
But I'm wondering what it was like to be to shoot the final part and know, like, okay, now the show is really over. You know, having worked on the first and the last episode, and I'm also wondering if you went back and watched the pilot before shooting the last one.
Yeah, I did. I went back and watched the pilot for sure, and you know, a few other episodes as well. But it was bittersweet. You know, I think Homicide went on two seasons too long. I mean, financially, I don't think so. But I think creatively, it went on maybe two seasons too long. We were desperately trying to stay in here, and our powers that be were trying to, you know, second guess the audience's needs. But The Wire, I think, to me, I would love the show to go on. I would love to spin off Gus Haynes and have a newsroom show. I mean, I think there's a lot of life left in this idea. But since it was decided that it was time to go, it ended really strongly, in my opinion. It ends, you know, it's a good way to wrap it up. So it was bittersweet, but it took forever to shoot because every time we wrapped a character, a series wrap for a character, we'd stop and acknowledge their work and they'd speak and then we'd all cry and then we'd start shooting again. So it took weeks to finish. And then after that, I went out to California and it was a couple of months later and did the same thing on The Shield because The Shield is now ending and I shot the very last one of The Shield. So it's like, what am I, the series killer now?
Not a serial killer, but a series killer.
A series killer. So it was, again, bittersweet because, you know, I really was fond of that show, too, and it was also well-written. So when you look at the television landscape now and you see how much crap is on there, and especially now with this writer's strike, it's that much more poignant that we are losing two great shows like this and The Wire, especially that, you know, it still could have gone on, in my opinion. I think there's way more cities in that stories in that Naked City.
Clark Johnson will be back in the second half of the show. He directed the pilot and the upcoming series finale of the HBO series The Wire. And this season, he plays Gus Haynes, the city editor of the Baltimore Sun. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of Touchstone, a novel of suspense and intrigue set in Britain between two world wars by Laurie R. King, author of The Game. From the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. And from the Vital Projects Fund, supporting the Museum of Modern Art, now exhibiting etchings by Lucian Freud. Details at moma.org. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a just-issued live album from 1997 featuring singer and pianist Andy Bay and a reissue featuring him and his sisters. And we continue our conversation with director and actor Clark Johnson from The Wire, The Shield, and Homicide. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Clark Johnson. On this fifth and final season of the HBO series The Wire, he plays Gus Haynes, the city editor of the Baltimore Sun. Johnson also directed the pilot and the second episode of The Wire, as well as the forthcoming series finale. He has a similar place of honor on the FX cop series The Shield, having directed the pilot, the forthcoming series finale, and some episodes in between. And back in the 90s on yet another cop series, Homicide, he played Detective Meldrick Lewis. Here's a scene from Homicide in which Meldrick is interrogating a drug lord named Luther Mahoney, who's been charged with conspiracy to commit murder. Meldrick and another detective from Narcotics are trying to get a confession of murder from the drug dealer. The Narcotics detective speaks first.
You know, we did a raid on Ashland. Bojack's stash.
Oh, the late Mr. Reed. We had a nice long run before he fell. You find any of that poison?
We did. Not all of it, probably, but enough to convince us that the bad bags were from his crew.
Well, that they were.
Well, he was pointing a finger at you.
Are you suggesting a motive?
Well, you have, say, a theoretical drug slinger. You know, he's marketing a viable product, proper purity, proper cut. Until some no-name, know-nothing, old-school, just out of Jessup, knucklehead, starts messing around with his home chemistry set, and he starts killing off the customers quick.
As opposed to killing them slow.
Even if this drug slinger, this theoretical drug slinger, was a reasonable man, I mean, the guy might be compelled to act.
You know, your case makes sense. I like it.
I like it, too.
Except I don't sling bags, and I didn't kill Bojack Reed.
Then who did?
A guy named Carlton Phipps.
No, he's dead, too.
You know, I heard that.
See, our problem is that we don't have any way of connecting Carlton Phipps with the murder of Bojack Reed. Well, see, I worked that case. I talked to Carlton's people. You know what they told me? They said that he was despondent. They may even have taken his own life.
He killed himself. He shot himself in the back of the head. Who are you fooling? He was murdered. Bojack's people came back on him. I mean, he had the gun that killed Bojack right on the table. And...
Let me ask you this. How do you know where Carlton caught that bullet? And let me ask you this. How in the hell do you know what was on the table in front of the man?
Well, the word was all over about what happened to Carlton.
Oh, Luther, 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 you just fell for the oldest trick we got, baby.
That's my guest, Clark Johnson, as Detective Meldrick Lewis on an episode of Homicide. How'd you get the part in Homicide?
I gotta, but go ahead, before, go ahead. Eric Dellums, he's a great actor, and he played Luther Mahoney. And I've used him a few times. I call him the Clark Johnson players, and he's one of my actors that I... He played Baird Rustin, a pivotal character in my first film, Boycott, and pivotal in the Civil Rights Movement, a completely different guy than that. It's just, you know, from a saintly civil rights activist to a ruthless drug lord is a great switch.
Well, how'd you get the part in Homicide?
The classic actor story, you know. I was in California, and I really despised the town of Los Angeles in a lot of ways. I was struggling there, and sleeping on a friend's couch, two young kids back east, and trying to get going. And the one last audition before I go home with my tail between my legs was this thing. It's Barry Levinson. That was the only name I knew at the time. Auditioned for a new cop show. And I go to read for the casting director, and there's no script. There's a book, and it's a book by David Simon, Homicide, The Year on the Killing Streets. And they said, pick anything from there and read from it. So what? So I read from the actual book. And then, of course, the process continued, and I went back to New York and met Fontana and Barry, and you know, subsequent auditions later got the part. But that was the initial audition. And I read that, and I went, this is something that's going to be groundbreaking. I just know it.
Was there a lot of dialogue in it that you had to read?
Yeah. I mean, his book, I don't know if you read it or remember it, but his book is like a screenplay in a lot of ways. There is a lot of dialogue in it, so it wasn't hard to pick stuff out. And I think my character is a combination of elements of that book that Paul Attanasio and Simon, and Fontana and Barry Levinson concocted, but also elements of my own experience of having played a cop on another series and my uncle's back home in Philadelphia. with the pork pie hat. So it was a combination of things that arrive at that character.
Did they ever explain to you why they had you read from the book instead of reading from a script?
There was no script yet.
Oh.
As far as I know, there was no script yet. So, you know.
So tell me about your uncles in Philadelphia, who you just referred to.
Well, I idolize my uncles. I'm actually writing my parents' life story right now, and they're a colorful bunch. And my Uncle Duke in particular was the coolest cat I knew, and then my Uncle William was the second coolest. And they both wore little pork pie hats, but my Uncle William's hat was always just a little too small.
Which your character wore. Yeah, go ahead.
Right. And my Uncle William's hat was always just a little too small, which I thought that was hysterical. So I thought, Mel just got a pork pie hat. It's just a little too small. It used to fit.
Right. Right. Now, what did your uncles do?
You know, regular round-the-way stuff from West Philadelphia. My Uncle Duke was a you know, late-night maintenance guy in a downtown office building. And my Uncle William, God bless him, really didn't have a job since he got out of the Army after the Second World War. But he managed to get by. He always had something on the go. And they were very much influential in my young life. I wanted to, and the scripts always supported this. I wanted to police the streets of Baltimore from a position of being from the streets of Baltimore, from, you know, knowing why a guy says what he says and why he had to say what he says. Not so much what made him think that, but what made him have to say what he said. And you only know that from knowing where he's coming from. I mean, you know, you could say one thing to somebody when it's just me and you in the room, Terry, but if my homie's right beside me, I might not be able to respond to your question the way, you know, I honestly would if my homie wasn't there. You know what I mean? So that dynamic as the cop that I'm playing respects and understands that dynamic and the specifics of it. So you can't do that if you just drive around in a radio car. I mean, that was the difference between, say, for instance, on the Shield with the LAPD. It's a big, huge jurisdiction. You can't walk foot there. You can't get to know your neighborhood. You don't have a neighborhood. It's got, you know, 500 square miles is your neighborhood. So they're detached. They're in their cars. They don't know their Damon Runyon characters in their neighborhood. Whereas in Baltimore, you arrested that guy 8 times last week. You know, he sat in the same coffee shop as you did this morning. So it's a completely different way of looking at things.
How familiar were you with the kind of streets that you patrolled in Homicide and that you told stories about in The Wire?
Well, I come from West Philadelphia, and, it, you know, it's a rough and tumble neighborhood, and that I drew from. But, you know, I don't do drugs and I don't sling drugs. And so, obviously I don't have a specific reference about that. But we did get in there and get talking to people and get hanging out. And I rode around with the cops like every cliched actor does. And in fact, the second day that we were in Baltimore, Kyle and I were riding with one patrol car. And they had a call that they were responding to. It seemed like a minor domestic thing, and went up into the high rises, and over their radio, and a couple minutes later, we heard shots fired, and that turned out to be a cop was shot, and it became part of the storyline for us. Lee Tergesen played the cop that was shot, and in this case, killed, but our character survived and was blinded. So this is me driving with some cops and watching him deal with the reality of their world. It sort of humbles you that, you know, we're a bunch of spoon-fed actors, but we have to play these guys for real, and that involves seeing what their world is like. And it's pretty important for us to get out there and feel it with them, but no more so than is supported by the writing.
My guest is Clark Johnson. He played Detective Meldrick Lewis on Homicide. Now he co-stars on The Wire as the city editor of the Baltimore Sun, Gus Haynes. He also directed the first 2 episodes of The Wire, as well as the upcoming series finale. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Clark Johnson. In the current season of The Wire, he plays the city editor at the Baltimore Sun, Gus Haynes. He also directed the first two episodes of The Wire and directed the season finale, which is coming up in a few weeks. He directed the pilot of The Shield and several other episodes as well, and played Detective Mildred Lewis in the series Homicide. Your parents are from very different backgrounds. Your father is African American. Your grandmother and his side cleaned houses for a living. Your mother is white. She grew up, I read, on what, Fifth Avenue or something in New York.
Yeah, partially, yeah.
So, did you feel like you had a foot in two really different worlds when you were growing up?
No, because and that's part of what my script is that I'm writing about my parents is that my mother was disinherited. She her maiden name is Clark. She comes from, quite a successful family. Parents split up and they both remarried. And her mother remarried quite successfully in financial sense. And so my mother on that side went to Spence and, had a doorman building on Park and 72nd in Manhattan. But when she married my father, that was taken from her. Her father said that she died in Europe and never spoke to her again. So she became my grandmother.
Was she disinherited because her father was African American, or for other reasons?
Right, right, right. Because they shamed the family. I mean, that's the tragedy of that. Deeply disappointed her father, and that completely surprised my mother because he had been one of the lawyers, a military lawyer in Nuremberg trials, involvement in the desegregation of the army and the Truman administration, so he was a liberal for his time, but it's that classic, not next door, not my daughter, it took her by surprise. So to answer your question, I never really had that side of the family until years later. So there wasn't, and both my parents got involved in the civil rights movement fairly early in my young life. So she became one of us as opposed to me straddling a fence of two worlds.
So when you were growing up, did you identify as African-American or biracial?
Absolutely, always. And that was totally encouraged by both parents. The idea of walking down the street and only being affected by a half in terms of racism, it really doesn't make much sense. I come from people that had to sit in the very back of the bus, not either or, so my blackness was never an issue.
And what about as an actor? Has race been an issue as an actor, and have you played people of different racial backgrounds in movies and TV shows?
Not really. I mean, early in a young actor's career, unless they're very lucky, you tend to, you start getting the roles of cop number one or a dead guy on street. And it says African American, and a lot of times they look at me and go, "Oh, he's too light skinned," or they wouldn't say it outright, but I'd know that they want somebody that more ebonically speaking or more whatever that fits their stereotype of what it means to be an African American. So early in your career, you deal with those prejudices and preconceptions, but then as you go along, obviously, race was a factor in me playing Gus Haynes on The Wire, for instance, but it wasn't something that they went, "Oh, well, he's not black enough to play this role." So they start to forget that sort of thing when you have a track record as an actor. You start to get roles because you can play the role as opposed to what you look like at that moment.
Did you say race was a factor in The Wire?
Well, to a certain extent. I mean, I'm sure they were. It's interesting to them to have an African American in the newsroom. The Baltimore Sun, sadly, is pretty much lily white, and I think it was Simon, a little jab at the Sun, saying, diversify. It's a city that's a 60% or 80% black. And yet, this isn't reflected at all. So that had something. But two speaking characters in that whole newsroom that were black, so it didn't really go too far. I'm sure that had something to do with it, not in a sinister way, but it's, just reflecting on it is all.
Now, your parents, I think your father's is or was a professor.
He was, yeah.
Of
kinesiology, he taught phys ed and kinesiology.
Mm-hmm. And your mother set up development or relief programs in
right.
developing
yeah.
countries?
Right, yeah. She worked for relief organizations like Save the Children and sending university students overseas and you know, very, very energetic and enlightened, you know, global citizen. She spent a lot of time in Africa and in the third world in general, setting programs up, teaching, you know, setting up teachers or engineers or whatever is needed in a particular area. So as a kid, instead of going to summer camp, we would be in Bogota, Colombia, or Haiti, or some place where there was a real need for American help, and that's what she did.
That must give you an interesting perspective on race and ethnic identity when you're a kid to travel like that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, my upbringing is interesting because leaving West Philadelphia as a kid and growing up partially in Toronto, it's a different perspective on what I didn't learn the word ghetto until I came to Toronto. I never heard that word in Philadelphia. So a different perspective on, that's how you see.
How did you know that acting was right for you?
My mom took me to an audition. We were all in a church choir and always sang in the kitchen and goofed around. And my mother thought it'd be fun to take me to an audition, me and my actually youngest sister Molly, to an audition for a production of South Pacific in New York. And we got it. So they would... When there was an East Coast show starting up, and this is in the 60s, you know, the big touring musicals, they'd say, get those Johnson kids. So the four of us would be in these great shows like Porgy and Bess and Finian's Rainbow and South Pacific. So I got the bug early, but didn't really. Again, you know, I went to one audition. I wasn't a stage brat. I just did one audition, and I grew up in the wings.
So what's one of the best songs you got to sing?
Oh, God. The very first song I sang was in French, and I didn't even know that there was a French language. I was 9, and I sang Dites-moi in South Pacific, and that was that was fun. I'll sing it for you right now.
Please.
No, I'm not. I'm not.
Oh, come on.
I got a cold. I was 9.
That's always something. you grew up partially in Canada and live partially there now.
Right.
And you did some of your early film work with the great Canadian director David Cronenberg, and I think you worked on the Dead Zone, Videodrome, and The Fly.
So yeah, I did special effects.
Tell me something great you learned doing special effects for David Cronenberg.
That he loves blood.
Yes, he does. We talked about that, and he's into the different kinds of blood.
I know. He's such a... I mean, he's really a... I mean, I was like the fifth special effects hand on all his movies. I barely had the courage to say hello to him when I worked on his cruise, but I got the sense that he's just a really nice guy, a really normal guy, you know, crazy thoughts, but a normal guy. And to see the movies, you go, wow, that's the same guy. And I'm sure that's true of other directors, but I thought that was interesting. You know, I cut myself on the Dead Zone. I fell off a truck and opened up my arm to about 38 stitches and a pint or two of blood. And he came with a little pail and said, let's keep the blood.
Oh, no, really?
Yeah.
Did he use it in the film?
That was really no.
Oh, okay.
I was doing effects. I was blowing stuff up. We were doing. There was a scene where we had Chris Walken. This is going back a ways. Chris Walken is in a burning room, and it was big, huge scene. He took the time to come over and see if I was okay.
So did you hurt yourself while Christopher Walken was getting blown up?
Yeah. Yeah, it's part of it, you know.
Did you get a good shot out of it?
Well, I guess they did. I'm just holding, you know, I limped off. I mean, what am I going to do?
What were you doing? What were you doing in that shot?
I was the effects guy. I was off camera, you know. I forget what specifically. I think I might have been tripping a bomb, you know, knocking something or lighting a fire bar. I can't remember. But it was a big scene where the whole room catches on fire.
Okay.
The good old days. Well, I still love effects. I kept doing special effects up until right halfway through Homicide. I would still take calls to go, you know, flip a car or something. I got a kick out of it. Still do.
Well, Clark Johnson, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Fun to talk to you too, Terry. Thanks for having me on.
Clark Johnson directed the pilot and the upcoming series finale of the HBO series The Wire, and this season he plays Gus Haynes, the city editor of the Baltimore Sun. Tomorrow, we'll hear from the actor who plays Omar on The Wire, Michael Kenneth Williams. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews two albums featuring pianist and singer Andy Bay. This is Fresh Air. Andy Bay was a child piano prodigy and teenage pop singer before he began touring in the vocal trio Andy Bay and the Bay Sisters. Later in the 1970s, he recorded with Horace Silver, Stanley Clarke, and others. But Bay's career really took off when he was rediscovered in the 90s. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a newly issued Andy Bay live album that isn't exactly new.
Jonah, he lived in a whale. Oh, 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 Jonah, he lived in a whale. For he made his home in that fish's abdomen. Oh, Jonah, 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 he lived.
Andy Bay on piano and vocals, bringing out the gospel in It Ain't Necessarily So from Porgy and Bess. It's on Bay's album Ain't Necessarily So, a belatedly issued live date from 1997, early in his ongoing revival. Bay has extraordinary range as a singer. He can play the romantic baritone like Billy Eckstine, but he'll also swoop over and under a baritone's normal range, from a strong falsetto to a sub-bassment. And he may fade from a holler to a whisper as he does it. He doesn't mind showing off what he can do, but doesn't lapse into mere showboating.
I'm preaching, preaching, preach, preaching my sermon show. That it ain't, that it ain't, that it ain't necessarily so. Preaching.
Andy Bay has a great feeling for Duke Ellington's music. He can jab the piano like Ellington and has recorded a few of his tunes. Duke's I Let a Song Go Out of My Heart gets knockout treatment here. Ellington loved eccentric soloists but didn't always hire the best singers, so it's tempting to imagine what he might have done with this virtuoso.
I let a song go out of my heart. It was the sweetest melody. I know I lost heaven. Cause you were the song. Since you and I have drifted apart. Life really doesn't mean a thing to me.
Andy Bay's made some very good records since his comeback, but this superior one gets an extra boost from the bass and drum team of Peter Washington and no relation Kenny Washington. They lock in with Bay the pianist and make him more of a rhythm singer, as on this upbeat version of Depression-era tearjerker, Brother Can You Spare a Dime.
Once in khaki suits, cheap we look, might as well.
Half a million men went slogging through hell. I was a kid with a drum. Say, don't you remember my name is Al? It was Al all the time. Say, don't you remember I'm your pal? Brother, can you spare a dime?
Bay's taste for pushing the limits goes back to the family act he had with elder siblings Salome and Geraldine 45 years ago. Bay fans may have missed, but shouldn't have, a recent reissue of 1966's Round Midnight by Andy and the Bay Sisters. There's more Ellington, more risk-taking, and plenty of evidence Andy Bay was already special way back when, even if he had to wait another 30 years for the payout.
Memories always start at midnight.
Haven't got the heart to stand those memories when my heart is still. End of midnight. Oh, midnight.
Kevin Whitehead teaches English and American Studies at the University of Kansas, and he's a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sherrock. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Darling, I need you. Lately I find you're out of my arms and I out of my.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, presenting daily book reviews, author interviews, and more in the Barnes & Noble Review, online at bn.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
When you walk through the garden. On the next Fresh Air, the actor on The Wire who plays Omar, a stick-up man who robs only drug dealers. Omar has a scar running down his face. That's not a prosthetic scar, it's real. Actor Michael Kenneth Williams will tell us the story behind his scar and lots of other stories. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
He's got fire and the fury. And his.